Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're back for part two of the offensive discussion. The offense discussion. Offensive. It's occasionally offensive. Regarding the Steelers wild card game, the Ravens, obviously, this is a fun discussion. If you didn't see that, listen to that first episode. Jordan Coe joined us. He's back here again. How you doing, Jordan?
Good. Glad to be back, Ken.
Caught you mid-swallow there, didn't I?
All right. Did.
appreciate having you back on. Great spirited discussion in the first session. Some fantastic football stuff. And we figured out, we talked a little bit about the all-pro voting and how we think that works. And the information probably is out there, and there's people who know this already. But the fact that Lamar won 30-18 first place votes, we don't necessarily think is the most important thing, because it has to be, as I would look at this, a 3-1 point scale where you only get to vote for two people in the all-pro. And Lamar seemed to get 30 first place votes and 19 seconds, while Allen got 18 first place votes and 24 seconds. So he was not named on 8 ballots. And the 1 Lamar ballot and 8 missing Allen ballots were replaced by Burrow, who got 9 total votes, 2 firsts and 7 seconds. So the point being here, and maybe chime in on this, Jordan, but we don't think that a lot of that Lamar is going to lose very many second place votes on the multi-tiered MVP voting that will come out. I don't know whether it's 1-3 or 1-5 on that, but I know there's more spots than there are on the all pro voting.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, and that was what I had read, that those secondary votes to Burrow are the ones that are the genuine threat to Allen getting the MVP. I think that there is, okay, and I am as spirited about the teams that I root for as anybody else is. So this comes with zero criticism, but I think that there is an unbelievably blinded desire to see Josh Allen win MVP for some reason, right, by Bills fans, that like, I don't care if Lamar loses MVP this year and the Ravens win the Super Bowl, I won't blink twice. And quite
both
frankly,
fan bases, by the way, would say the same thing. So it's not really any concession to do that.
Right. So what I would also say is that if Lamar doesn't win MVP this year, I won't care. we know how good Lamar is. They know how good Josh Allen is. Neither team is moving away from their guy. And there are going to be plenty of other seasons where Lamar is going to miss some games. Josh Allen is going to miss some games. Patrick Mahomes is going to miss some games or continue to kind of see his career decline, especially maybe after Travis Kelce is gone. Right. Any of all these guys have opportunities to win. Even Burrow, if Higgins stays in Cincinnati, are going to have opportunities to win the MVP. I just don't understand the fervor of it's got to be this year. Well, he's done all this the last 5 years. Okay, he's gonna have 4 more MVP or more campaigns in his career.
Okay, style. I'm not as sanguine on that point as you are. I think it's less likely that there are a significant number of additional MVP. Close MVP campaigns for each player. I think, you know, Allen probably comes close once more in his career would be my over-under expectation. Maybe it's 1.1, 1.2, but it's not 4 or anything. I mean, Allen's not going to have 4 MVP-esque seasons. Lamar, he's a very special talent, so it could be more, but I still think the over-under on him would be like 1.8 in terms of, and you can't over under 1.8 because you got to say it is or it isn't in the end on one, but my expectation would be, you know, 1.8 or something would be his number of MVP campaigns he has left. It's they're not going to be running against each other, and there aren't a whole lot of opportunities. Allen missing this time is missing out on the lifetime achievement award that I think Bills fans would like this to be. I mean, it really is a huge missed opportunity if he doesn't get it this year. Okay.
Interesting.
Anyway, our different sides of the
yeah,
same argument.
Yeah, I think we definitely see that potentially a little bit differently. But we'll see about if Josh Allen stops turning the ball over consistently in his career, then he will be consistently a top three MVP vote getter.
Yeah.
So it's just a question of whether or not you think he's going to go back to that.
And if Josh Allen can consistently be a better quarterback, he could improve his passer rating to 120. And yeah, then he's always in the discussion. But that's very unlikely to happen. So let's talk a little bit about scheme in this, because there are a few things. We didn't see any Mitchell on offense. So a great division of Henry and Hill. Both of them made contributions. Hill, a little bit less successful as a runner, but that pass at the end of the first half is just, it's an etched memory. It's a seven wonders kind of memory of having been there and seen the great pyramids or whatnot, that we won't forget this.
I think, you know, what's great about that play is that was, and this is my reference point for Tre'Davious White playing more against Josh Allen. Mm-hmm. That was Justice Hill recognizing what Patrick Queen was going to do on that play, because they practiced against each other for all those years, and deciding when he was supposed to stay back and block Patrick Queen to release. Like he said, even after the game, the call was not for him to release, but he kind of knew that Queen was going to run up the field, was going to try and keep contain on Lamar. There wasn't a threat in terms of like where that window was for Lamar to go, and he knew he could release. And so tendencies are a thing. The Ravens need to continue to take a look at Brandon Stephens and Tre'Davious White. Okay, moving on.
Fair enough. So Henry carried or targeted on 26 of 40 snaps, 26 of 45, and Hill on 10 of 29. They didn't run a single snap of Pony. We talked about Keaton Mitchell being a guy that might come in the matchups episode and probably avoid more of that misdirection. They really gave that role to Sims. In the offense, it wasn't anybody else really. It wasn't Aguilar. It wasn't Wallace. It was really Sims who was providing a lot of the misdirection and the one carry they had for 15 yards was actually made them have to respect that.
Yeah, I think it was we're not going to show you what we're going to do later in the playoffs, which I mentioned earlier, that I think that if the situation is a closer game and demanding more from your playmakers in those circumstances, that is very likely that it could be that Aguilar is going to be in that role, that it could be Keaton Mitchell, that there's going to be other considerations in terms of where ultimately it gets to.
Yeah. Let's see. I want to talk about the heavies per play, because the Ravens are at their highest of the entire season at 2.39 heavies per play. Obviously they played heavy and that worked. And so they stayed with that. And it was 2.39 heavies is the 2022 level, basically. It's, in fact, slightly higher than what they averaged for that entire season when they were the heaviest team of all time. And I think literally the heaviest team in a relative sense in the history of football. It's certainly been decades, and it may have been ever. But anyway, Andrews played 61% of the snaps, Likely played 80% of the snaps, Ricard 46% of the snaps, Kolar 30% of the snaps, and then they added 16 OL6 snaps. 15 of them went to Jones and one to Cleveland. So heaviest were the three brands of offense that they had in this game.
And it's great that the Ravens defense got to practice against those offensive sets, because that is exactly what the Bills like to do. They bring in their sixth tight end often is a big guy, former or offensive lineman that plays in some of those running sets. So good practice for a week to be able to do that. Good practice to be able to come back to it and be ready for it. Michael Pierce played cornerback one played. Michael Pierce should replace Brandon Stephens. Yeah. Cornerback one played 8 snaps this week.
Yeah. He played only 8 snaps and they only got 2.3 yards per play when he was out there, including a sack by him. So Michael Pierce has had a couple of games like that since he's returned, where despite all evidence of inability to play physically, he's been remarkable. And I think the first time he did it, he had a more significant snap total. Like it might have been 19 or something he played in that first game that was really well done. But anyway, targets were pretty well split. We don't need to talk about that. Mentioned the 6 set and 16 chip blocks they used. You talked about the layered passing game a little bit, but that is something with Lamar Jackson getting 3.23 to throw on average, is that your chip blockers have more value as receivers in that scheme. So you get a late release guy that can actually help you more than he would if Peyton Manning at age 38 is running your offense.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, that's exactly right. And the Ravens have been chipping all year long. They have a really good evidence on tape of what that looks like, what defenses are going to throw at that, how they want to attack that, what the options are on those routes behind them. I think we're going to see a lot of it in the game against Buffalo too.
Good chance. They have guys on both sides who could, who can certifiably rush the passer. What else to say? Sims had 13 snaps. Miller had 9 snaps. Tez Walker kind of got the short end of the stick with only 2 snaps. Aguilar had 20. And Wallace led the team in wide receiver snaps with 39, 4 more than Bateman had, which is, I think, probably an indication of who they like better as a run blocker.
And certainly in the second half, who wasn't going to be on the field. there is certainly no risk to let Bateman be exposed to any potential injury in the second half of that game, given Flower status.
Great, great point. So it was a protection thing. I would agree. That makes sense. Didn't have any high A-dot guys in this game as a group. The Ravens had just one missed tackle force. That was likely. And we talked about that earlier in terms of the total missed tackles being kind of high, but kind of low still, or kind of reasonable by rate anyway. I guess we should move on and take a look at the offensive line now. Let me get my notes together here.
I mean, I got a question for you when we jump into the offensive line about how is it more difficult to rate these offensive line games when they're running the ball so heavily, where I know that there's a lot of your system that's built around pass rush and how these guys are handling pass rush. Not a lot of pass rush in this game to evaluate.
Right. So the simple answer is yes. But a lot of it is also built on pulls, getting to level 2, getting highlight blocks on combinations that give you some bonus points to overcome from some other mistakes that you might have. So that's important. The standard I use for blocking is they need to hold that block for slightly over a second. And I don't time those the way I time ample time and space, because it would be too much timing inside the game for me to really do it. By the way, I just wish people would start doing all their games at 30 frames per second. I don't think there's enough of a difference for 720p broadcasts to go to 60 frames per second to put me to all this freaking difficulty in terms of timing things, because it's a lot more clicks on my own beef about this that nobody else gives a crap about. Overall, though, a fairly average opportunity set provided for Jackson in this game. They only allowed one sack that was on an ample time and space play. Lamar ran them out of one pressure that was created by Linderbaum. I mentioned that in the first episode. They had 3 false starts. One of them did stall a drive. The other two were the best kind of offensive line penalty you can have. Basically, a pre-snap penalty, no defensive option. It's a -2. It still hurts your score a little bit, but not like a holding penalty hurts your score, for example.
Yeah, and before we get into the individual players, did you make anything of the minimal, you know, there was some chatter about this officiating crew being stingier with offensive line penalties and holds and calls accordingly with that. We did not see a lot of that. There were some pre-snap, 3 or 4 pre-snap penalties that we did see happen in this game. Some of them were jumps, some of them were, you know, other related things. But have you been seeing improvement from a penalty and offensive line perspective, or was this just a fluky game because the Ravens were just running straight at the Steelers?
Okay, so there are a couple players. I mean, there's probably some of both of that, really. When you ask the question that way, there's almost certainly some of both of those things. But one of the guys who's improved a lot in the last few weeks, since week 13, McCarrie's only had 1 false start penalty. And before that, he'd had, well, I can tell you, it's 46 points worth of penalties and 3 games of 10-plus points he'd lost on penalties. That often means 2 holdings or you know, 3 penalties otherwise to get to that kind of level. So at least in McCarrie's perspective, he's been improving. Not everybody has been improving in the same margin, but I'd say generally speaking, the offensive line has had fewer penalties. And I think there's a good draw for the Ravens to get a crew that's not particularly penalty happy. I heard, though, they were more penalty happy in the secondary calling some of those flags, this group was. And the Ravens didn't have a single defensive foul in the whole game. So while you look,
yes, because they were getting cooked. They were getting cooked in the line of scrimmage. The pass to Pickens on the right, Wiggins just got absolutely, absolutely baked in the line of scrimmage, which happens. I mean, Pickens is a good wide receiver and Wiggins is a rookie. But I think that might have something to do with it too. But yeah, why don't we jump into the offensive line? You know, Ronnie Stanley, one of the hot topics. Is he going to be a Raven long term here? You know, did you see something from him? What did you see from him in this game?
I mean, it wasn't a particularly good performance by Stanley. I saw he got the game ball after the game because they had a big game rushing. And there's nothing wrong with Stanley's pass blocking. It was all, well, there's sorry, run blocking. But there was things wrong with his pass blocking. So he made 56 out of 70 blocks, which means there's 14 plays where something went wrong. Six of those were missed blocks. Two were half penetrations where he shared with somebody else the responsibility for a loss on a run play. And then six other plays he's involved in a pressure. And all of them happen to be pressure. So he didn't allow the quarterback to be hit even once. No quarterback hits, no sacks. All, in a sense, it's a good Stanley mirror game. Highsmith was just backing him up right into Jackson's lap a lot of the time. And that was the problem, was really Alex Highsmith is a little too much for Ronnie Stanley right now. He gets a big adjustment, but he scored only 0.57 per play, including the two false starts as well. I think that is probably a legitimate case, by the way, where Stanley is trying to cheat a little bit to get out of his stance quickly. And is getting called for some false starts. Don't think that's crew related at all. And his 0.65 was his total after adjustment. I give him almost the maximum adjustment for Highsmith, but still a D. Only had one level two block and one pancake in the game. So he didn't do anything with mobility to make up for what was honestly a pretty poor passing game. I saw that PFF has him graded somewhere up in like 75 or even higher in terms of a pass blocking grade. I don't get it. I don't get it. If you want to like look at my article, that'll be out. It'll give you the exact time references on this plays. I think you'll see exactly what I am in terms of he's getting really pushed back into the lap of Lamar on a lot of these plays.
So two follow-up questions. One, are you concerned about Stanley's potential performance against Von Miller in this game against Buffalo?
Von Miller usually is on the other side, right? I think he's usually
they move them around because I, you know, having recent, I've rewatched the first half of the Broncos game. Russo had a couple really good run stops on the against the right tackle, so I think they move them around, or maybe Von Miller just wasn't in for those snaps. I also did see Von Miller and Milano run Knicks out of bounds together on the right side, so I'm not sure.
Did you get a sense from what you're seeing of that Von Miller was trying to line up opposite the tight end side of the naked tackle, or that they were trying to get Russo matched up on that? Because that often will decide it. Like Suggs, they would always try and use him in a rush position, whether that was left or right. And the Ravens have a very strong tendency to be right-handed. So they dictate that to the opponent a lot, that their rush guy, the guy they really want on the rush side, is on that side. And for the Steelers, that's Highsmith. You wouldn't necessarily expect that. So a lot of people would think it's Watt, but Watt's almost always on the tight end side.
No, Watt. I thought Watt exclusively plays on the right side. I'm almost sure. And that's always just been his thing, and that's been one of the knocks on people that Watt doesn't go up against the best tackle for the other team all the time. But I'll have to take a closer look as to see whether or not we're worried about Stanley versus or where Von Miller's going to line up. But they still have a decent suite of Ibanisa, Russo.
Oh, yeah.
Von Miller at rotating through there. Are you concerned about Ronnie Stanley going into this game?
I mean, I'm always a little bit concerned. Ronnie is a good left tackle at this point. He didn't get any all pro votes, and that was appropriate. Daniel Falele did get an all pro vote, and that's probably not appropriate. but anyway, it's
the guy covering from Australia.
I don't know. I really don't know what the scoop was. He's played really well recently. We'll get to that bit. But Stanley, I'm going to have concern whoever he's with.
So second question. You think the Ravens are going to extend Ronnie Stanley?
It's the biggest decision of this offseason is how they do it. And I think how they'll approach a lot of this is basically the left tackle need they have to solve. So it's the first question. But all the other ones, I think it's they'll do it by competitive offers and basically create a prisoner's dilemma situation for these various players. It's very similar to the baseball draft, where between picks maybe 10 and 25, you have a lot of high school pitchers that you like. And you pick 15 of them, or actually, since it's 15 picks, maybe you pick 10 pitchers in that group. And then you make offers to all of them. And you say, okay, you can get $1.2 million, you get $800,000, you get $700,000, you get $400,000 as a signing bonus. And the ones who accept the money first get it. And you know, there's only so much money to be allocated. It's kind of like the cops come to you and say, not to you specifically, Jordan, although I wouldn't put it past you for this to ever happen.
Definitely
not. There's only one deal. There's only one deal going to be given here, Jordan. You turn rat on your friend, or I'm, you know.
You know, what I think is interesting about that question, too, is, you know, one, I think we've seen enough. I mean, Voorhees' health is a question at left guard, but I think he's almost directly penciled into the left guard spot next year. You've got Linderbaum at center. You've got a question about whether or not Rosengarten is a left tackle or a right tackle, right? But that's 3 of 5 spots. So 60% of your offensive line is relatively already filled, which is better than it's felt. Like, even if today we assume that Ronnie Stanley wasn't extended in any form or another, 60% of the offensive line feeling like it's more intact is a much more comfortable place, I feel like, heading into next year than we've been in. So I wonder if it's one of those situations where the Ravens feel like they're one of two ways, right, with their free agents. They're like, this is the deal that we're willing to go up to. We're going to offer it to you. And if you don't take it, you can go shop it around, but we're not. There's right. No negotiation here, right? They did that with Ray Lewis. They did that, quite frankly, with Lamar Jackson, right? Like, mm-hmm. This is what they do. They said, this is the deal that we're going to offer you. Have at it, right? And I think that we might be in that situation with Ronnie Stanley.
It could be. I don't think there's a big hometown discount to be got from Ronnie, but it could be that he'll take $1 million less to continue playing with Lamar Jackson, to continue towards a Ring of Honor membership with the Ravens. The things that go with that are soft. So if I were Ronnie Stanley, I wouldn't give up more than 5% of my contract value to do it, but I might play for 57 instead of 60. On the other side of that, the Maryland situation with taxes is probably taking him exactly the opposite direction and saying, look, I don't want to play in New York or Maryland because they're high tax states. I want to play in Tennessee, maybe, even if they got a lousy team. Or I could want to play in Texas, certainly, because they got no state income tax. Florida, same thing. There are players who might make their decision based on that. The players who do are entirely based on that are, frankly, the sort of players you generally don't want around. There are exceptions, but the first thing you got to do is never, ever, ever speak about it to anyone else. You can let your agent know. Your agent can talk to the team. But Rafael Palmeiro came out and he talked about how the offer that Texas gave was really better because they gave me $2.5 million in Baltimore. But it's really like after taxes. It's like, I mean, the average guy who's, you know, got a blue collar job or just, you know, is middle class has no interest in the financial, you know, tax situation of Rafael Palmeiro. And it's just not going to feel, you know, it's not something you can try in the court of public opinion. Just shut the hell up. You know.
Yeah, I think Messina had the same problem when he came out and was like, well, this deferred money, and he pulled his I'm a Stanford guy, and look, like, here's the logic. And I think that there was more of a draw at that point, given how competitive the Orioles were versus the Yankees to go there too. That was a component of it. But he made a huge fuss over the deferred money. And I know a lot of people that loved Mike Messina before that were much more lukewarm on him. Well, after
the Orioles, frankly, should have been equally ambivalent to paying deferred money to Messina. It can be a divisible benefit situation where the club pays less and the player can accept less because the tax on that money is a lot less. And you and I both know a retired baseball player making nothing who gets, you know, his first $1 million a year in deferred income from contracts that might've happened 20 years ago is in a much better position from tax purposes, and there could be a little bit of gain for both sides in that.
And that's exactly what the Dodgers, we're down the rabbit hole here, but that's exactly what the Dodgers are showing with almost $1 billion of deferred money. But the reason why they can do it is because taxes are so high in California that Ohtani knows that he's may not even be in the United States, but certainly probably isn't going to be, or figure out a way to make his the place that he's earning his income by the time he's retired, not California.
Yeah, Florida, Texas, either Tennessee, if you really want to go there. But there are several states. Anyway, we've been over this tax rabbit hole a couple of different times before.
Yeah, so you know, we talked a little bit about the penalties of McCarrie. What did you see from him this week?
So it was a good game for McCarrie, I thought, and I noticed that PFF had him for some pressures, and I really need to get with Gordon and ask him where those were, because I only see one shared pressure as I've got it. But 70 plays, 60 blocks, 7 missed, 2 half penetrations where he shared in a run loss, 1 half pressure that I saw. I think that was a share with Stanley. So it was a good game for him. You know, 57 points, .81 was his points per play. He got a good adjustment because he's opposite Cam Hayward a lot of this game. And, you know, that's a tough assignment. So a B overall for him, 4 level 2 blocks, 4 out of 6 on pulls is nothing special. Did have 1 pancake. He's playing very well right now. B for this game. And let's see what he's done. I did have 1 bad game recently, and he got at 1 game where he was out. But McCarrie the last few weeks has had ACAB in his last 4 games. With the Cleveland game, he only played 6 snaps because he was sick. So he's been playing very well. And even when he was having all the penalties early in the season, I was defending him because his non-penalty points per play on blocks were much higher than a lot of other linemen. Now he's up to 0.79 overall for the whole season, which after adjustment would put him in the B range at guard. And that is a that's just a nice place to be. The Ravens don't have a lot of B offensive linemen at this point.
Well, and at the end of the day, it comes down to not committing penalties for the way this team can move forward, like not getting behind the sticks. I mean, if you look, you go back and look at that first loss to the Steelers and the drives that ridiculous interceptions and missed kicks didn't happen. It was holding on the offensive line that was slowing those drives down, too. It happens to every team. Offensive holding is almost as bad as a sack in almost every instance. You don't lose the down, but those 10 yards are brutal. And so if they can stay out of those penalty situations, which Lamar can bail you out of a lot of those too, if they can stay out of those penalty related situations, then B quality play from a guy like Makari is going to go a really long way. And I think that's exactly what we saw in this game against Pittsburgh.
Going back to that point for a second, a holding penalty on first down. One of the big problems is it gives the defense the option. So if there is a sack on the play, they get the sack anyway. If there's an interception, you know, they take that. But the other part of it is that a first and 20, and this is based on some work that Dan Reese did about the Ravens 2019 offense, which might not translate to offenses in general as well, but it might translate to the 24 Lamar offense. It might. Anyway, what he found was that a first and 20 was approximately the same as second and 14 in terms of how difficult it was to pick up to get a serious success out of that time. And right there, that should tell you it's about the equivalent of a 4-yard sack. So that's a good rule of thumb to do it, is you avoid those holding penalties to get behind. But otherwise, completely agree, and they do stall a lot of drives.
So what about Tyler Linderbaum, our all-pro, now expensive, and I know concerning to you, potentially long-term center?
Yeah, they've
only from a salary cap perspective.
Yeah, no, I he had a great game this game, by the way. 70 plays, 64 blocks. He got run out of one pressure by Lamar, which was the only pressure Lamar ran the offensive line out, but he missed 6 blocks, and that he didn't have any negative events. 0.91 score with an adjustment. He's at the A level, had 7 level 2 blocks, which led the team, had 2 highlights, which was nice. So very fine game from him, particularly as a run blocker in this one. Not bad as a pass blocker also, even though he's been, in particularly in recent weeks, been pushed around a little bit more, certainly than he was in 23, and still doing better than he was as a rookie in 22. But it's been a year of kind of having to consolidate some of those gains as a pass blocker that he had last year.
Well, I think in the context of how this is going to play out in the Buffalo game, I think Tyler Linderbaum is primed to have a very good game against Buffalo. I think they're a little soft on the interior of their offensive line. Ed Oliver is kind of the big name that you see there, but they don't have that big body to like really go at the thing that we all know that is Linderbaum's potential biggest weakness, which is strength right up the gut, straight at him. There's no kind of Vita Vea. There's no Casey Hampton style player. If we want to talk about Pittsburgh, those guys aren't going to be there for Buffalo. And even like a guy like Ed Oliver's on the downside, the downswing, he's not a bad player. I'm not saying that, but he's on the downswing of where his career is. And I think there's a real opportunity for Linderbaum to get to the second level, to be able to shed some of these guys on the defensive line and really do some damage here in the Buffalo game. So it's good to hear that he had a quality game leading up to that in this Pittsburgh game too.
Yeah, Oliver List is 6'1", 287. So he's smaller than Matabike. And Matabike is a guy, if you lean on him, you can certainly get him to move. This is a game where Daniel Faulele outweighs him by almost 100 pounds. And he's a guy who should be able to get physical with him. And it's fortunately something we've seen from Faulele in recent weeks, which is very exciting.
Well, let's talk about the big man himself, the all-pro getting offensive lineman from the Baltimore Ravens, Daniel Faulele. Okay, what did you see from him this week?
He did get a vote. It's a very big deal getting your first all-pro vote. I remember when Ben Powers got his in his big final season with the Ravens, how big a deal it was. But very similar game to Linderbaum in a lot of ways. 70 plays, 61 blocks. He missed 9 instead of 6. So that's worse. But also, centers miss less than guards, so the grading scale is tougher at center. 0.87 points per play. 0.05 is his adjustment this week. Playing a variety of guys. And actually, he gets some lower quality Steelers defensive lineman. That's where the hole in the Steelers line is between Watt and Hayward, who normally plays opposite the left guard or in the left A gap. And so that is tends to be their weakest player. But then when you look at what he did additionally, he had 6 level 2 blocks, 2 pancakes, made 6 out of 7 pulls. And by the way, that's not Fa'alele. Like, Fa'alele's had a lot of trouble pulling and connecting. 4 highlight blocks, all of them highlight combinations. He just did a much better job this week of connecting on his mobility concerns. So that was positive. To get 2 pancakes in a game doesn't seem like much, but Fa'alele's had a lot of trouble picking those up. And he needs to be more physical. And this was a game where I thought he really did a better job of using his arms and finishing. He probably was kind of feeling it as the game went on and really wanted to get some Steelers on the ground when they were, you know, kind of tired out by the situation by the end of the game. But really good game. And the last 4 weeks for Fa'alele, I'm going to go right through the scoring here for 1 second. He's had B-minus A. His last 4 weeks. He's on a terrific run right now. During that entire time, he's only given up 2 pressures, 0.5 and 1.5, 0.5 in the last pit game, 1.5 against Cleveland. No quarterback hits, no sacks, no penalties, and only 1 penetration. So he's doing it basically by having clean sheeting some games in terms of the negative scoring events.
Well, I might have just understood Fa'alele when I said that the Ravens have 3 offensive linemen.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Headed into 2025. You know, if 4 are locked in, then Ronnie Stanley, Wright Voorhees, Linderbaum, Fa'alele, okay, and Rosengarten.
That was what I was saying. Is if you're really considering Voorhees as set, then yeah, you're at 4. I thought you were going 3 because it was Linderbaum, Fa'alele, and Rosengarten somewhere.
Yeah. And I think guard is a backfill spot where you can, if you like the upside of what Voorhees is going to give you, you get somebody that's going to be available to play backup. Rosengarten, you decide to move left or right. You make an offer to Stanley. Like you said, you make an offer to Stanley, you decide what that's going to do. But look, Fa'alele was not good early in the year. I think we can all agree on that. Has improved a lot, and a lot of credit has to go to the coaching staff of the Ravens. A lot of credit has to go to John Harbaugh's commitment to sticking with Fa'alele. I think ultimately when everything comes down to it and all the pieces are ultimately said and done about the value that Fa'alele is going to bring back to the Ravens, the amount of surplus value of getting a guy like him to be able to move in to guard and be a guy that plays is going to be significant for the Ravens down the stretch here. The cap is tight already. It's only going to stay tight as long as Lamar Jackson is here. And being able to take a guy that you're drafting in the 4th round and turn him into a starter that you might be able to get on one of those like mid-level extensions, like non-elite extensions, which is I think he is primed to be, is really significant benefit to this team.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the two guys who are primed to get those contracts right now are Washington and him in terms of being mid-level guys. It's going to be harder to sign a Travis Jones or an Isaiah Likely. If they sign Isaiah Likely, Likely may almost want them to decommit from Andrews to do it. Like if they traded Andrews, maybe Likely would want to sign for the thing. I think it's going to be actually very hard to sign Likely. And then they've got other guys like Owe, who's looks like he's a real player now, and they want to make sure they try and get him signed before his 50-year option year is played. There's just so much. They have
some decisions. They for sure have some decisions that are coming up, and then they're going to make. They're going to need to make. But I also think that from a core perspective, this team is mostly intact, even with the potential free agents that are coming up. So if you can clean up the cap, the Marcus Williams deal was huge in terms of being able to move that up for like keeping the team competitive for next year. I think Andrews Likely is the big question. You know, it seemed like Andrews might be done early in the year, but that seems to be completely injury related exclusively. And if you're going to have a guy that's going to score 10 touchdowns out of every 12 games, then you can see a long-term Kelce Lamar type relationship that they play their entire careers together in Baltimore. And when they're done, but they're going to win a lot together.
All I can say is thank God the Ravens are in this position with a ton of heartbreaking potential, the decisions that they have to make, as opposed to the other one where they have to go find somebody else's players and sign them. I mean, if we had to go out and sign a Patrick Queen, that would be awful. If we had to go out and sign somebody else's leftover player, and I'm not talking about getting a backup half field safety that you're signing for 2 years, $5 million. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking when you're forced to go out and get Earl Thomas because you think your defense is falling apart. That's where you really tend to get boogered on these deals.
Man, I am so I mean, I guess I'm not surprised. I find the Patrick Queen situation to be really peculiar on his part, knowing that his deal is non-guaranteed, knowing that business is business with the way the Ravens run their front office, that it's not personal, that it is about the cap and it's about business, and knowing that there is a very real possibility that he could have been a free agent the upcoming year and had to take a below market rate for whatever reasons, because you just don't know what's going to happen, right? Yep. An inside linebacker, off-ball linebacker is just like not one of the highest paid positions. I mean, I don't know whether the Ravens would bring him back on a $3 million deal if that was the best deal that was out there. I think they should if that were available. But I don't know if that bridge is burned at this point. I mean, I would gladly bring him back for $3 million on a one-year deal. I wouldn't blink an eye.
Sure.
Yeah. No, even a two, even like a 2.75 with like some weirdo stuff like built in around that, be happy to do something like that for Patrick Queen. It would be a significant upgrade from everything they got at inside linebacker this past year. He knows Roquan well. I think it would add a lot of stability to the defense. I think they missed him this year. I mean, they missed him this year. I don't think Patrick Queen is a great player. The Ravens definitely missed his presence in the middle of the field this year. We know that based on what happened in the first half of this year and the continual rotation of the inside linebackers now. But I don't know if that bridge is burned. I mean, it seems like he still seemed cool with the players, but the front office takes that stuff seriously. Deontay Johnson seemed cool with the players, and his butt is gone.
Right. I mean, I would agree. I think there might be something about the aversion to contact, which Queen occasionally had on display here, that they just would not live with. And you'd have to be convinced that Roquan Smith could keep him in line. And of course, you don't have to be convinced in a one-year deal because it's not a big gamble. The problem is mid-range contacts are what the Ravens really need to avoid. They have a few important ones that they need to get. Another good split field safety. They need to get that from the draft, or they need to get that in a contract. And they might need both. They need to find a backup tackle, whether that's McCary, Jones, or somebody else, because three of their four tackles are going. It's not just the starting left tackle. They need to figure it out in terms of a backup. They just have a lot of either draft capital that you really would prefer to be fungible in the early rounds that they might need to apply to specific need positions, which is really not what you want to be involved in, or they have to go out and spend some money on mid-range contact. I don't think I'd spend $3 or $4 million more on an inside linebacker. Even, you know, if an incentives to five kind of thing, I'm out on that.
Yeah, you know, a five is too much ultimately in terms of where I would get on that, but three is irrelevant to the cap.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Fair enough. So follow Lilianne in this game anyway. So a great finish for him.
Yeah, we're happy to see it. So, I mean, let's round it out with, you know, we talked about him a little bit earlier with the chips and his handling of TJ Watt, but, you know, where do things lie for Roger Rosengarten for you?
Yeah, it's hard to get a read on who he is exactly as a pass blocker just because he's not getting that responsibility all that often. But 70 plays, 59 blocks, 8 missed, 2.5 pressures allowed in this game. Watt was kept off the stat sheet defensively as a whole, which is something the Ravens PR people, media people are big on. So Ryan Mink was posting stuff about how he had Watt was kept off the stat sheet and whatnot. It's true, and it's a good thing, but it's not like Watt didn't have any pressures in the game. He did have some time where he was threatening the cone. It wasn't a bad game by any stretch. It's a 0.74 though raw score with his adjustment. I couldn't give him the full 0.10 because he's not really taking all the Watt responsibility personally. So I gave him 0.06 of the 10. He gets up to 80 and a B-. Four level two blocks, three pancakes, 3 out of 4 on pulls, had a highlight. There's nothing other than the three pancakes, which is really exceptional. There's nothing really exceptional about the rest of that line. So he's, you know, he's had a good year. It's just, I'm kind of not yet at a point where I'm like, no doubt about it, Rosengarten can move to left tackle and take over for Stanley. I'm just not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately that's probably the right place about where we are on this. And I'm also okay with Ryan Rosengarten being a right tackle for his career. If that's a great, like if he's a great right tackle, I think that would be just fine in terms of a second round pick for what the Ravens got, right?
Oh, sure.
Is there a great offense, yeah. Right? Like we're happy to take that. And I know that, I think we did the second round together on a draft podcast, and a lot of people, I was high on Rosengarten. I was really ecstatic that they got him in the second round. But my recollection is that of like maybe the 6 or 7 people on that stream, I was the only one that was positive about Roger Rosengarten.
I you know, Sua Mataia, who has not turned out to be the pro player that Rosengarten is at this point, I like better from a athletics perspective. Rosengarten also really did not like his anchor. I thought that was a huge problem. And the Ravens have not given that a chance to fail, to their credit. They really have not left him on an island to anchor against Watt, for example, and get beaten by him. And that's it's been a big help to him. And it's not anything, it's no slam on Rosengarten to say that. It's just, I don't think we've seen yet proof that he's the left tackle of the future. It's open. It's a possibility. I'm just saying
it's a possibility. And I think all of us would be happy if he's the right tackle of the future as well.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, think there are, you know, and I don't know what the free agent class looks like for left tackle next year. I don't know what the draft class looks like for left tackle next year. I mean, but you were mentioning it. I mean, if you look at the Ravens 2025 salary cap and who is on the roster for next year, Ronnie Stanley, I think, and Brandon Stevens are the only two guys in a meaningful starting capacity role. Maybe Harrison and Board aren't under contract, but those would be vet minimums anyway if they brought them back. All the other starters are still on the roster for next year.
Yeah, they actually had bubbled free agency years where they had a big one after 23, and they have a big one after 25 as well, a really big one. So it'll be a tough year if they don't get some of these guys signed. It'll be players like Travis Jones leaving, and Isaiah Likely, and Ardarius Washington, Daniel Falele, you know, maybe a little bit lesser, Adafi Owe leaving. I mean, it'll be a tough year for free agent departures.
And for, luckily,
some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Got four comp picks slated to come in. We'll obviously find out about that later, but four comp picks slated to come in headed into 2025. So at least there will be another plethora of bodies kind of following up to be these Falele type players to be able to fill into these roles. Harrison too.
Yeah, it'd be interesting how that works out, because Queen is one of the guys they're depending on to, I think, return a fourth round pick, and I don't know if it's going to happen, but we'll see if that ends up being the way of it. Real quick, Josh Jones was in there for 15 snaps, made 11 blocks, missed three, gave up half a penetration. It wasn't a great game in terms of what he did at 0.67 overall. Doesn't get a grade for that because it's not 20 snaps, which is the minimum. But he would have been in the D range, or sorry, if it had been a tackle, I guess he'd been in the low C range getting that after adjustment. It's just it wasn't a particularly attractive game from him. What was interesting about it is the Ravens threw him out there in effectively the same exact alignment, play after play after play after play. We write down the formations, and when he's in, it's almost always 1-22, 6-L or 6-R, and they ran the football. I mean, it's just play after play they did that. 1-2-2 means one wide receiver, two tight ends, and that's defined by how they line up, not defined by what they are on the roster. And they just ran this. It was just that and this mirror image every single freaking time with Josh Jones on the field. So he should have suffered a little bit from the fact that people knew exactly what he was trying to do when they were in there. I mean, there were various run schemes you can run off of that same alignment. But yeah, he was solid enough in this game, just not spectacular.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what Buffalo does in this upcoming game when they need to commit to the run. And how they're trying to approach that in terms of what they do, because the Steelers are always trying to create a gap somewhere and get somebody firing through that gap and trying to make the play. And I do wonder, obviously we did not see success in their efforts to do that in terms of what they were doing against Baltimore. It'll be interesting to see if Buffalo tries to do the same thing, only because, and I don't know why these guys say this, I think it was Ed Oliver. It was one of the defenders for Derrick Henry today. Oh, we're not that worried about him. You know, if you stop him in the backfield, then he can't get ahead of steam going, and we're really not all that worried about it. And like,
why do that?
Yeah, to what end? And Derrick Henry seems like one of the kind of guys that cares the least about. Like, he doesn't seem to need to be to get motivated by those kind of things. It's kind of like Lamar is not motivated by the MVP conversation, I don't think, at all in the least. He said that he keeps the trophies literally in a box in his closet. Like, they aren't on display, right?
I mostly believe that.
but he has said that, whereas Josh Allen, when he talks about it very differently, right? Like, when Lamar is asked these questions, he's like, I don't care about MVP. All I care about is winning a Super Bowl. When Josh Allen is asked these questions, that's not the way and the style that he answers them. And even if he started answering them, like, let's say all hell breaks loose and we were very sad next week because the Bills have beaten the Ravens, and Josh Allen changes his tune about how he says it then about the Super Bowl, he's never talked about it. Like, Lamar has talked about winning the Super Bowl from the minute he was drafted by the Ravens. It was always the thing on his mind. It's always been the thing on his mind. And if you follow him closely, you know that to be true. I just don't, like, they're just not built the same way. And as that portends to the upcoming Buffalo game, I think that Josh Allen can get in a situation where he will press. That he, like Josh Allen has done a great job up this, and we talked about this earlier this year, of not turning the ball over, right? Like, not doing some of the crazy, like squeeze balls into windows that he shouldn't, kind of go off script when he shouldn't, moments, check those balls down when he needs to. I just wonder whether or not some of the pressure of all of that and wanting to, especially if they're chasing in terms of the score, if he throws an interception early, they get behind early again. We already kind of saw it when they played in week 4. And for all the chatter that everybody wants to give that Milano's back, Taron Johnson is back, the weak side linebacker is back. First of all,
Milano,
those things are not going to upgrade it enough for anybody against this rushing attack. I'm sorry, they're just not. But even beyond that, the Buffalo Bills defense has declined over the course of this entire year, even once those players have returned, right? And you look at what they did against the Jets, and you look at what they did against the Patriots at the end of the year, two teams that were already in Cancun as well, and they were putting up offensive numbers. That backup quarterback for the Patriots, I can't remember his name, Joe Milton, mm-hmm. It's like, oh, he's got trade value now because he was dialing it up against the Bills defense. You know, they have just been – Trent almost losing to the Patriots when Allen played 2 weeks before that. They've headed in the wrong direction around all that stuff while those guys have been back. And so I'm not saying anything about what that means. I'm just saying that it's not as though as those guys returned, we already saw a significant bump in the quality of the defense that Buffalo was getting. I don't know why that would make a difference exclusively in this game, but not the last third of the season.
There's one thing for starters is there's never a reason for a grandiose statement like that that gives you a chance to just get burned by it. It doesn't do you any good. But two things about this. One is no defense is truly built to stop the Lamar Jackson, Derrick Henry offense. No defense was ever really built to stop the Lamar Jackson and a bunch of average guys offense in terms of stopping their rushing attack. And we saw that from 2018 on. In terms of just how effective, I mean, first there was some newness value to it, I suppose, but they outrushed everybody by a, you know, 150 yards and whatever in Lamar's 2018 season when he wasn't throwing the ball very much. And then in 2019, of course, it was still new enough that they set the all-time record for yardage in a season. He's turned every average back that's come to this town into a very good back, and he's turned a great back into the greatest season of all time in 2024. And that's what Aaron Schatz says, is that the 2024 season for Derrick Henry is the best of the century for any running back. That's number one. So even if you can stop the run, even if you think you can do all the scrape and crash and chase and replace crap that you need to get Lamar Jackson contained, to get the other players contained properly, you don't need to talk about it. And I agree with you. You're right about Henry, and Lamar, I think, is in the middle, but Henry doesn't really care a grudge. And I don't think it means a lot to him in there. I think Lamar is in the middle. The guy I think sometimes does and is willing to lash out at a player is Roquan. Roquan, you know, had some nasty things to say about Patrick Queen, but he had him coming. He said some things all year, and it's good. I mean, Roquan waited to the right time to basically say these things. You don't want to be the 2000 Titans and whip back at the Ravens for some of their stupid trash talk at the inappropriate time right before you're playing them and motivate them on the on their scoreboard at home.
The 2020 Titans too, right? Like the whole logo thing. Like it's just like you don't need to, these guys don't need any extra motivation around some of this stuff. I think Lamar is motivated to overcome this playoff narrative about him. So he is at his full threshold in full because of that. And he knows that it's got to be him. He knows he's got to lead the team. And he knows he's got to not choke this away in some of the ways that he has in past years. Right. So like that is what is motivating him. Again, I think you're right about Derrick Henry. I think Isaiah Likely might be a guy that needs like a little, like he was amped for this Steelers game and he was amped to run block in the Steelers game. And if we get that version of Isaiah Likely every game down the stretch of this season of these playoffs, it's going to be really hard to beat the Ravens. He's the X factor, and even more so with Flowers hurt. But I think even before that, he's the last, like if you go through the progression of like how you have to stop the Ravens, he's the last guy that really is kind of like, okay, we're going to do all of these things to take all these things away.
Right.
He's the guy left standing of, okay, there's nothing, like if we do all those other things,
there's no asset really sure to handle Likely. And whether that's Likely the blocker or Likely the
correct. That's what makes him that real X factor.
He's Likely would be a guy I'd really want to coach on the side and say, please don't talk. Like maybe your personality, you may want to put up a stiff front for these guys. It's the worst thing for the team. You're our secret weapon. Please just shut up. And you can
also
do that.
Cover the ball.
and the other thing you can do is basically not put them at the podium. They can do that, but they still have the open locker room time where the people can go up and talk to individual players. And hopefully they can do two ways. They can go to the media and ask them not to go after Likely and get them to say anything that's going to make us look stupid. But they don't really want to do that. They don't really want to control the media in exactly that way to do that. They want an open media thing, but just tell Likely. God, just tell him. Don't say anything.
They don't talk. The Ravens, quite frankly, don't talk a lot of smack to begin with, especially before games. And I don't know whether that's
version
or not. Yeah. But in addition to that, I can't remember anybody else saying anything. I guess Say Flowers actually is probably the most prone to run his mouth.
Okay. All right. Well, fair enough. Let's talk skill position players. We've kind of let this go a little long, but that's okay. It's a great discussion. Who would you like to talk about that maybe we haven't talked about so far in this episode?
I mean, let's talk about Rashad Bateman, right? Your wide receiver one right now, playing unbelievable football. Like his ability to, at the top of stems, be able to create separation, to manipulate defenders, to be doing all of that within the offense overall. And I think, you know, I talked about this earlier about how I know that there's some Ravens fans out there that do not like how the Ravens space the reads. They play a lot. They probably play a lot of Madden. And so when they're looking at the screen, they can see all four receivers at the same time and they can turn from looking at the guy all the way to the right and they can throw it to the guy all the way to the left and it doesn't matter. But that is really a difficult thing to do for any quarterback, right? That's part of the reason why they say don't throw back across your body, because all of those things that are like adding up to that. When you have a system where you have to go through your progressions like that, you have to have receivers that understand what their roles are within those, how to create separation within those spaces, and how to use other players within those spaces to do that. And so sometimes you get those instances where guys run a little bit too close together. That's just what happens when you have these option style routes and you have these progression style routes when these kind of things happen. It's unavoidable. You can watch the Chiefs play. It happens to them too, because they run this. I think they run the same similar style progression read offense. I don't think the Bills do the same thing. Just for not that I think that's a bad thing, but I just from a for the record kind of perspective.
I'm first of all, I don't disagree even for a second. And I thought a lot of the criticism of Roman in this regard was kind of misplaced. And there's often a group of fans who think they understands everything about route concepts, or they've watched three videos on the topic and they think from that they know everything about, right? It's very complex and nuanced exactly what you're trying to do to opposing cornerbacks with how you release the leverage on that. All of that is very nuanced. There's much more to it. One thing I think back to is wasn't the Aguilar play. It was a couple of years ago when Geno Stone had an interception in a game against the Bengals. It might have been 23, because Geno Stone had his big year then. And he crossed into the middle of the field, intercepted Joe Burrow on a really nuanced set of routes that was basically intended to pull him off that spot. And he even talked about it after the fact. And he said, well, he released inside. Or he released outside. So I knew I was free to go over. And in fact, that's not what had happened. And basically, it was like you're trying to run a complex bluff against a poker player who's basically at my level, a guy who doesn't know what he's doing for the rest of the poker world. And you can't manipulate a player like that because they don't have the basic skills to figure it out. But and they, anyway, this it was there's a great Ben Solak analysis of that play that I loved, and there's a lot to it, and the people who say they completely understand it, I have that much of a jaundiced eye that I apply to that discussion. And yeah, it's like, oh really? Well, tell me more about that. What would you look for in this kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, and if you don't know the play call and you don't know which routes are option routes and which routes aren't, uh-huh. And if you don't believe in the NFL that there are three options for every receiver on every formation on every route, then you don't understand how sophisticated the NFL is and why there's a huge gap in quality of play from college to pro, right? Like all of these guys constantly have a variety of options and things that they can do based on the types of coverages and the types of things that they're seeing in front of them. And we will never know what those options are because we can't.
All right. Getting back to Bateman for a second, incredibly happy with his play. He certainly has been, I think you're right also that they were really trying in that second half to keep him off the field, given the current state of the receiver room. They can't afford it to get any worse. I listening to Harbaugh, I don't get any sense at all that Flowers is going to play this week. And I have a grave fear that we may not see him again until camp. So is this a sad situation? The Ravens are going to have to find a way through. It is not going to be an easy route to get there without Flowers. It's going to cost them significantly on offense. They're going to have to lean on the run game, but they did everything they needed to. And admittedly it's the Steelers, but the Steelers are also a good team at defending the run game that they present. They did everything they needed to in terms of picking up the other options that they need to, meaning Lamar runs the football as much as required. You do all the motion you need to do. All your guys, now, you don't have a number one receiver in the sense, this is a point I made in recent weeks, is you really don't have a number one receiver, period, in a Lamar Jackson offense. Because you don't ever want to be forcing targets to somebody at the expense of options for Lamar. Options for Lamar have to be the number one for the offense, period.
And I think in that sense, Rashad Bateman can fill the first guy when Lamar looks to throw the ball roll because of what he has showed us at wide receiver. Now, how that affects things downstream do, like you said, ultimately have an impact. Being able to go from Zay to Rashad Bateman is effective. Being able to use both of them to dummy and decoy things into that effectively also makes a difference. But at the end of the day, Rashad Bateman has proven to be an excellent wide receiver and really living up to his first round draft status now.
Yeah, completely thrilled with him in terms of his second contract players who are out there right now in the NFL, which Bateman kind of is, kind of isn't. But if you treat him as a second contract player, he's got the most valuable contract right now in the entire NFL or very close to it. There's nobody who's making less for doing more than Rashad Bateman, who set two Ravens records this year. He had 10.5 yards per target, which was the highest ever by a wide receiver, second highest only to Andrews in terms of yards per target for any receiver. And then he also set the wide receiver touchdown percentage record at 12.5%. And nobody had only three guys had been that high before, and likely Andrews this year and Mark Ingram in 2019 was up at 29%, incredibly. I'm sorry, 17%. It was 5 out of 29. I'll name one player here, just to do one here. I think the Ravens really benefited from having Charlie Kolar back. Obviously, he didn't play a ton of snaps, but Kolar and Ricard were out there and contributing heavily to the 2.39, as were OL6s. And you'd rather have that base, that at the beginning of the game, when you want to have the threat to receive, you want to have Kolar be one of those players. I don't think he actually had a target in this game, but having him at the line of scrimmage in line, very valuable for the Ravens. No, he did not have a target.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you need to get him warmed up and back into game shape and available to do those kind of things. I think he's going to pop one big play at some point in the future of these playoffs, whether it's this week or in a potential future week.
Save it for the Super Bowl.
Exactly. I mean, and so the next guy that I would take is his counterpart, Mark Andrews, who is, you know, again, I mean, Andrews has really just rounded back into the complete form of what we saw from him before the injuries about midway through the season, and has his ability to manipulate defenses, find spots in zones, be the safety blanket for Lamar in terms of what he needs to do. And with the more Lamar is mobile in these games, and the more the threat of Lamar is mobile, the more damage that Mark Andrews is going to be able to do down the road. Not a big game in terms of what he did against Pittsburgh, but again, we're still seeing the same guy that is the one that we needed to be back.
Yeah, I completely agree. He's been a huge upswing the second half of the year. The way that Andrews and Bateman and Likely are all finding space, sitting down in it, the level of comfort with Lamar is very high for all three of those guys. It's great to see that long drive right before the half. And I did want to comment on this. There were six completions on that drive, but basically how those plays went should give you incredible confidence in Lamar driving down the field. So they got the ball with 1:53 left. They ran the ball twice with Henry when they were basically saying, we might want to run out the clock here and not try and give them a ball back. But Pittsburgh called a timeout with 1:08 to go, and the Ravens had to go for it on 3rd-and-2. Completed pass to Bateman. That's the first completion for 9 yards. Then they have first down. All of a sudden, the Ravens want to go for it. They complete a pass to Aguilar for 25 after the roll right finds Aguilar in the middle of the field. They call a timeout. They go back. They throw a 4-yard pass to Miller. Not an ideal situation. Doesn't get out of bounds, but it's a completion. They have to call their last timeout. And now they've got 37 seconds remaining. They get to the line of scrimmage. They throw to Andrews. Not only does he get 20 yards, but I think he ran out of bounds on the play to stop the clock. Then they get the ball to Likely. Throw it to 19 yards. He takes him all the way down to the 5-yard line, picks up the football, runs it back to the middle of the field, puts it down. Lamar has time to get the spike down with 11 seconds to go. And then you get the play that's imprinted on us for good, which is Lamar running around the pocket, manipulating basically the blocker on Watt. The fact that Rosengarten's able to keep Watt contained for that point is because Jackson's doing his back and forth routine. Then he steps up in the pocket, releases to Hill for the touchdown. Six different receivers hit on six consecutive plays on that drive. That was a thing of absolute beauty. And I won't forget that component of it for as long as I live.
My favorite part about that touchdown to Justice Hill was Rosengarten. His back is to the end zone.
Yep.
And he's turned around and he's looking at Lamar. He's not even looking at Watt. He wants to see where Lamar is going because he understands that he needs to be doing whatever it is to get between Watt and wherever Lamar is going. And he doesn't know. And Lamar's like a joystick too, right? He doesn't know which way he's going to go. So he knows that he needs to be alert to do that. I thought that was my favorite part about that play. But yeah. I mean, unbelievable. Completely shut the door in terms of the game in its entirety, really dispirited the Steelers almost completely. It was great.
The Ravens had three drives of 85 plus yards for touchdowns in this game. The first time in the playoffs it's happened since at least 2001. That's as far as records go back. There've been 141 such drives of that length or longer during that time. The Ravens actually have 10 of them among themselves, just in their small sliver of games. They have, 7% of the total drives of that length. They became the first team to have three. The other thing that was incredible about this game is that 13-run drive. The 13-run drive had never been accomplished on an 85-plus yard drive. I looked at the same 141 drives. The only time it was done with one pass play was by San Francisco during the Kaepernick era. It was the year after they went to the Super Bowl. They were back in the playoffs. He threw an incomplete pass. Then he threw another incomplete pass where there was a holding call, and then all the rest of them were runs, and they got the ball in the end zone after nine plays. But incredible drive, just an incredible drive. It had to be the most dispiriting thing possible for Steelers fans.
Just a very, just an all around dispiriting game for Pittsburgh fans overall. We'd love to see it.
There you go. We got a couple of mailbag questions here. Can we try and do those here? Okay. So, all right, this was an interesting one. I want to get your thoughts on this too. So Rasmus, who I've identified as a burner account, but actually is a guy from Sweden who isn't trying to attract followers. He has only had one, but he says, I'd really like to hear your take on Harbaugh evidently either calling offensive plays or at least being highly involved, because he was covering his mouth with a play sheet that they caught on the TV view. and it's absolutely true. I did see this, and it was towards the end of the half. No, the end of the game. It was on the last drive of the game that I noticed it.
I didn't notice it. I wouldn't be surprised at the end of blowouts like that, that Harbaugh isn't on the mic and not talking about play calls, right? Like at that point, the Ravens are running to burn out the clock, right? Right. If they don't convert, they're kicking a field goal. At that point, they're up by 17. It's very much more Harbaugh style. And maybe he was doing this all game, but it's much more Harbaugh style to be rallying the troops, talking people up, giving credit on the headsets to the people that deserve the credit and making sure that people are hearing that accordingly. Then I know that he has a say in play calls. We know that from the Tez Walker touchdown. And we know that because John Harbaugh knows X's and O's. Anybody that thinks that he doesn't is an idiot.
Yeah, like, they are.
You don't live and breathe football for as long as he does and not know more than any of us have forgotten about football. Right. Yeah. So all of that kind of combined in terms of what it is, I think it was just a rallying cry and nothing to see here.
I've got another theory on this, Rasmus. I wouldn't doubt that that's true, is he might be talking about some specific thing. And, you know, tell Mark thanks for that call earlier. He hit it right on the nose, and he's saying it over the thing to someone who's an assistant coach in the booth. You know, that could well be it. I think also there might have been a component of this that was related to game management. And he's saying, okay, we got 6 minutes we need to burn out. We need to get this done. So we're going to go for it on fourth down. So you're free to call whatever you want here on third and four with that in mind. So I think there's some of that. And also, I can just see him, you know, holding up the paper he's facing. I said, I heard Jordan Coe has a parlay on this game, so we're going to need to make sure we don't get a field goal here. Because we're not going to get in bed with organized gamblers here.
Yeah, I mean, I think I could go either way, but like I would imagine from time to time John Harbaugh is chiming in about something play call or time management related during games. Like to think that he is not is the fodder of those who want him fired.
But it'd be fair to say that a play sheet itself is merely a mouth covering device and not necessarily anything that he's calling something from.
That is true. And correct. I absolutely don't believe that he's calling the plays, but in Rasmus's good catch, I did not notice this. I didn't see that. And it is interesting that he had a play sheet. I don't know that I remember whether or not he's had a play sheet in other games. I've never looked at that, not once.
Outstanding stuff. Great question, Rasmus. We appreciate you doing it. Okay, so Kevin says, how much heavy formation extra O-line 74 do you expect to see with versus a light front seven in Buffalo? When you have a light front, you might use it less. I don't think that the Ravens necessarily will put an extra heavy on the field, but then again, they might. And if they were, I would think it's more a function of Flowers being out and the other options they have at wide receiver, basically to use up those five eligible spots. But as you probably heard earlier in the episode, Kevin, they used 15 times. They used 74 in this game. So he was a guy that they went to a lot. They also used Cleveland once. So 16 OL, six snaps in total.
And Buffalo likes to play nickel a lot. And if they can catch them off guard and unwilling to sub in those situations, they should take advantage of it. And I do think that they are a little light up front in terms of their front seven. You know, Daquan Jones is a bigger guy. I think he's 6'4", 320. He's the biggest guy. But I mean, Rousseau, Miller, Ipanisa, we talked about Oliver earlier. They're not huge in terms of their front four, and they play a base 4-3. So even if they're staying in that base 4-3 and the Ravens feel like they're getting Daquan Jones matched up against, let's say, Falele, and they're getting a mismatch otherwise in terms of what they can do to Oliver and run the ball, I think that the weak spot of the Buffalo defense is going to be running it up the right up the middle at them in those situations. And if they're going to stay in nickel when the Ravens go heavy, then I think we're going to see a lot of Jones. You know, it's at the end of the day, it goes to what I said earlier when you asked the question about the weather. The Ravens are ready to play chess. And especially on offense, they're going to play chess with whoever it is that they're playing against. We've seen probably a higher level of chess versus checkers, if you want to call it that. I think that is a bit demeaning to kind of how sophisticated even Greg Roman's offense was. Mm-hmm. But I think we're seeing, if you're talking about the gap between chess versus checkers, I think the Ravens are exceptional at the top of the game now in terms of what they're bringing to the table in that regard. And so we'll see that matchup taken advantage of if they think there's something to take advantage of.
Yeah. Could completely agree. I mean, they showed a willingness to open a lot more run concepts. And they didn't, I don't even think they opened the whole chest. the whole playbook, really, in terms of blocking concepts, for example.
Traps, pulls, the minimal stuff over there.
So there's more to be done, in particular the trap blocking, because they'd shown that the last couple of weeks. We just saw some wham on the couple crack toss plays they ran that were both very effective, by the way. They ran one left and one right, and they're both effective.
Yeah, I don't love the toss plays, but they were both effective.
All right.
I think the toss plays could be more dangerous against a Buffalo defense, which is lighter and is quicker, a little bit more prone to shoot gaps from what I saw in the first half of the Buffalo Denver game. Those are the ways you blow up pitch plays, because they take a little bit longer to get developing. And if someone tries to read and can shoot a gap, especially between, let's say, Rosengarten and Falele, that can blow that play up in the backfield quickly.
All right. Well, fair enough. And hopefully that's what Patrick Ricard is for. But I'll take a counterpoint to that, is that in some of the Ravens losses where they had a devastating run game, and I'll specifically look at the 2018 game against the Chargers and the 2003 game with Jamal and the 2006 game against the Colts. They were all games where they had big size advantages on their opponents. But their opponents understood that and run blitz to death. It's actually, the Chiefs do it too, in terms of being a team that has been fairly successful stopping the run. It's not all game script. Some of it is just they're willing to do things to stop the run and leave the game in the hands of their corners. And it is a reason why I thought the Chargers with Derwin James were a team that might have given the Ravens a little bit more trouble. That they would have been, in retrospect, obviously the Steelers were a great opponent for the Ravens. But even if they knew them well, but the Chargers have already shown in their own history, a willingness to completely abandon traditional defensive concepts against a quarterback like Lamar when they went to an all quarter defense against the Ravens in that 2018 playoff game.
Yeah, and put all those guys up in the line of scrimmage, run a guy through a gap. Every time you can get through a gap, run through the gap, all those styles of play. I mean, that's not all that different from what Pittsburgh was doing in this game, though. They were, whenever they had a guy that could get into the backfield to get up to Henry, they were taking the guy and having him run up to Henry, and it did not work out for them. So yeah, I think the Ravens also have counters to that in the passing game, too. So, I mean, that's why we're going to watch the game. That's why it's going to be a good game.
All right, Randy Morgan has a question. He says, what were your thoughts on not going for it on 4th-and-2 from the 49 on the opening second half drive? Seem overly cautious with an opportunity to really put the game away with a TD. Let me start by saying 4th-and-2 from midfield is almost always a go for it for me. It's not even a question. For it to be not a go for it would have to be an extreme situation at the end of a game where you're maybe up 9 points or something with 2 minutes left. And then you might do better with punting it. But in any kind of neutral game script, a 4th-and-2 from midfield is going to be a go for it. I thought it was a conservative play. Up 21-0 at the time, the Ravens thought, we don't want to take a chance with it. I didn't really love it. And the fact that the Steelers got back into it, obviously, right after that with the long touchdown drive, made it look all the worse. But if you look at I think the Steelers' decisions were worse, because I think they were already playing at the end of their rope earlier in the game on the 4th-and-2 and the 4th-and-inches, that their decisions were worse for that reason.
Well, obviously I wanted them to go for it for aforementioned reasons on this podcast, but I'll give a different answer to this, which is that you only have so many 4th-and-2 plays already pre-booked, already practiced, already ready to go. In this circumstance, am I going to burn a 4th-and-2 play to put a team away when I don't need to? Or am I going to keep that in my back pocket, have a thing that we know we've practiced and coached, and it's one thing that we don't have to do next week, that when we get into that situation, it's there to call and it's not on tape yet. And in this game that was already put away, keeping it in your back pocket is actually an okay thing.
Okay. I would buy that if it was like a 2-point conversion play where it's, 2 points or none, and it really makes a difference in the game right there. Whereas this is a minor win probability change. In a relatively neutral game script, I think you've got 15 plays you can run in that situation, starting with all the variations on QB power you can think of to try and get 2 yards in that situation that I think are basically all legitimate calls. I don't think the playbook is so limited on just a regular neutral game script, fourth and two from midfield, plenty of space to work with. You know, defenders can't completely commit to the line of scrimmage and not give up a touchdown in that situation. I just think there's you have more to work with than that.
I mean, I think you do have more to work with, but I think the way you go in to practicing in the week is when we're in fourth and two situations, these are the things that we want to do, right? And whether you're in the middle of the field or whether you're a tight version of the field, those things are already like predicated, practiced, determined, and already laid out, right? We've heard coaches say this before. We didn't go for it on fourth down in the situation because we already used all four of our fourth and short plays earlier in the game, right? And so if that is John Harbaugh is an old school coach. I think Todd Monken is an old school coach in some regards. If that's their approach to what they're doing on fourth down, I think that it was just as much as being conservative about what the score was, for sure, as much as the Ravens didn't want to put anything on tape in the second half of that game, and they didn't. And I think I do think that was part of that decision. And I'm
I think that was evident there. I think it was also evident, maybe even more so on defense, that they didn't want to show special blitzes. They didn't want to show any of that. But you're right. I mean, not putting things on tape is worthwhile. And if they have, you know, some suite of eight plays they've never shown anybody, that, you know, and Roman always talked about, yeah, we got some stuff that we can do that's variation of this stuff, and then we got entire new pages we haven't gone to. And if that was the case, then I got no problem hiding those pages away. The versions of that everybody knows you're going to run, but they can't stop it anyway. Those are the plays I'd try and draw on. But anyway, I respect your point on that. Let's go to Angelove85, who says, "Hi Ken, what new run concepts did you see, and how can we expand against Buffalo? Also, many said they are a mismatch against our run game more than the Steelers, which bodes well for our offense as long as we execute." Agree. Okay, so I think he's saying the Ravens' run game is more of a mismatch for the Bills, meaning they're better than the Ravens are against the Steelers. We talked about familiarity earlier. You want to start with that in terms of how you feel?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in terms of familiarity, that's helpful. The Ravens have a deep bag of things they can go into, a lot of deception built up in the Ravens running game. I'm glad to see it back. I feel like we saw it really early in the season, and then it kind of went away in the middle of the season. And quite frankly, until the last few weeks, we haven't seen it quite on display the way that it was earlier in the year. So I also do think it's a complete mismatch. I think that the Buffalo is not nearly as good in their front seven in terms of what the Steelers were. And they don't know Lamar. Like, they don't know Lamar like Pittsburgh knows Lamar. And the Ravens should, knock on wood, all things barring crazy things happening, be in the 28 to 30 point range no matter what in this game, just because I don't think the Buffalo has the defensive horses to stop this offense from getting there.
Okay, well, I certainly hope you're right. In fact, I'll take 35 on this. Don't want to get into taking the over like you do, but anyway, that's a good one. I think there are additional run concepts they can throw in there, but I thought what we saw in this game was terrific in terms of using players we didn't expect to be used in gadget roles. For example, the Sims usage I thought was outstanding. And it's that much of the running game. He ran once for 15 yards. It's 5% of the run game for the whole day. Hill didn't run particularly effectively. And Lamar, I thought this is the biggest thing, is that they didn't have a cap on Lamar carries to try and hold that down. And that really made the Ravens run game go in this one. So when Lamar's running and where Lamar has the full privilege, as many runs as he wants, just really, even the best run defending teams cannot stop the Ravens. I get a little more concerned when the team's small, they know it, and they'll try and crowd the line of scrimmage. If that were to happen in Buffalo on a very windy day, I'd be much more concerned about the possibility that the Lamar is going to be able to punish the Bills defense for trying that.
And it does seem like Lamar has gotten over that hump in terms of what he's struggled with historically as well. But again, we'll see. I think we're going to see a lot of Hamlin and Rapp in the box. So, you know, much to your dismay in terms of what they're going to do, I think we're going to see plenty of that, Ken.
Yeah, we probably will see some eight. We saw some eight, we saw some nine, and they just kept running at it with their six-man OL in this last game. Got one more here from Matt. This is Cardi Matt. I thought this was Candy Matt for a little bit. But he says, "With Henry looking so locked in every time in every locker room video, Do you think he might retire on a high if the Ravens won the Super Bowl? Could we also see other vets retire? And he specifically mentions Pierce, Kyle Van Noy, Stanley, and Tucker. And then he asked, what would the cap implications be? But let's try and answer the first part of that, which is, do you think those five guys, that there's a risk of retirement?
I think there's a 5% chance that one of those guys retires.
Yeah, that would be about the number I would put on it too. I think it's almost a 0% chance. There are financial considerations for some of them in terms of still wanting to play a little longer. And most of them are just too damn good to sit down. There's going to be too much money thrown at them. It'd have to be a, I'm just too tired of playing this game and I'd rather do something else with my life. I can't see Justin Tucker doing that. He's just too spotlight oriented to want to move on to some other thing in life. I mean, that will help.
What makes him a good kicker?
Yeah. Anyway, Kyle Van Noy doing stand up. Maybe he wants to do that and move on from football, but he's just had a 12 and a half sack year. Why would he do it? I mean, why?
Yeah. Pierce might be the most likely, right? He'll be 32 or 33, I think, next year. But the Ravens are more than happy to continue to give him a part-time role in games that they don't need him. Let him play 8 snaps, let him get interceptions late in the year in junk time games, and, you know, use him when they need him, but, like, you know, use him appropriately.
He sat out a COVID year already. He would be the kind of player that I would have significant health concerns that might accrue from his weight. And if something like that were to come up, either a heart related thing or a diabetes related thing or whatever it might be, he's probably the most likely to retire. Yeah. All right. Jordan, always fun to do. Great mailbag questions, by the way, folks. Please make use of hashtag film study mailbag. We appreciate it. Even though we don't spend a lot of time on it every week, it's great material and we really love it. Jordan, always appreciate talking football with you. 2 hours and 40 minutes goes by in no time. With you talking about this, it's a spirited back and forth conversation. Really love it. I know people want to engage with you online. Tell folks where they can do that.
Yeah, you guys can find me on Twitter at Raven Sit Room. I'm going to try and get some. I've already been trying to break down some of the Broncos Bills film. Going to go back to the Bills and Ravens game. Going to put some stuff up there. Watched how the Broncos ran a read option light against Buffalo a few times. And if Buffalo chooses to defend that the way they defended Denver on it, Lamar Jackson's going to have a 60-yard touchdown. that's the teaser for something I'm going to try and be getting up on Twitter this week.
That sounds like a good one. I want to take a look at that too. Make sure you tag me when it comes out. Other folks out there, thanks a lot for being so loyal. And you're at the end of a 2 hour and 40 minute double episode here. Really appreciate you doing that. If best thing you could do for the show, if you want to, tell a friend about it, write us a 5-star 50 word review, or like, and subscribe if you're listening to it on, YouTube. That's the thing. And that's that new thing you kids are using nowadays to do that. Thanks anyway, for listening. Jordan, thanks again for coming on.
Happy to be here, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in / promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.